welcome to this podcast, Conversations on Faith and Equality. In this podcast today, we're talking about refugees, asylum seekers, and even a bit about migration generally. And I've got two brilliant people on the podcast, Fiona, who will tell you a bit about her story and what she does, but she's working in a church providing this safe place, they call it place of sanctuary, for people that they talk about as being sanctuary seekers, those who have come from sort of war-torn countries or places of conflict or places that are just not safe for them to be. And they've come here and the church is providing this place for support and kind of safe space to be in, particularly in the climate that we're in, where there isn't always a great warmth and love towards refugees and asylum seekers. So she talks about that. But the other person on the podcast is Maggie. And I just want to tell you a little bit more about Maggie because she is a really good friend of mine. We've known each other since we were 16. And before you kind of hear from her, I just wanted to tell you this story because it tells you a bit about Maggie. You know, I don't say this about everyone, but she was one of those people that I met and I just knew that we were meant to be friends. I knew that God had put us in each other's lives. And we've been great friends ever since. Love her husband, Matt, and her kids. And we were even witnesses at their wedding when they got married, and they played a really important part in our lives. But just to get a bit of a glimpse about Maggie. So when the Brexit vote happened, she, like many, was really disappointed. But she also is Bulgarian and grew up in Bulgaria, but then spent most of her teenage years in Greece, and then from the age of 16 has lived in the UK. She's married to someone's British, so she's got two British children. But when we voted to leave, so much of the rhetoric and a lot of the Leave campaign had been about immigration and a lot targeted toward Eastern Europeans. And as a Bulgarian, as an Eastern European, that felt quite personal for Maggie. And so, you know, lots of people reacted in different ways to the vote, but Maggie decided to do something about it. So she joined the Liberal Democrat Party, and they at the time were campaigning for a second referendum and doing everything they can to sort of try to get us back into Europe. And so she joined in the hope that she could do something there. And then, so she was campaigning, knocking on people's doors, talking to people, and then she said, oh, they're putting her forward to be a local councillor and in South Oxfordshire. And that sort of area, for those of you who know it, you know, it's very, sort of quite a wealthy area, so it's very conservative, always been Tory voting. And so she said it's so unlikely, but it's a great experience. You know, they've said don't even come to the election results because there's no way they'll win. But she said it'd been great to sort of get part of it, get to know people, go canvassing, get really involved in that. But she said, you know, they're saying there's no way that I'll win. The day after, the morning of the election results, I get a message from her with a picture of her as the newly elected councillor for South Oxfordshire. She had won. And she's now, as she talks about, she's on the cabinet, she's doing lots of things in that area as part of the local council. And it sort of shows a bit about what she's like. She's like, there's something that I don't like, there's an injustice, something that I feel like I need to do something about. And she gets up and she fights for it. And that's really what she's doing as part of her work as City of Sanctuary. She's really doing what she can to welcome refugees and asylum seekers and help people who she sees are in a really difficult position. So we talk about quite a lot of the myths and the preconceptions and the reality of what it's like for people that are coming from these places, from Iraq, from Syria, from Afghanistan, and why they need to come here and what it's like when they get here. So she is, as you'll hear from her, she's so bright, she's doing a PhD, she knows a lot about the subject. So I hope that you'll learn from her knowledge, but also from Fiona and her talking about really what they see in these people that they know and spend time with. So I really hope you enjoy this podcast and enjoy hearing from them. Thank you so much, Fiona and Maggie, for being here and being willing to share your experience and what you do. So just to start, I wondered if you would both tell us a bit about yourself and what you actually do. Maggie, do you want to go first?
Yeah, thank you, Bex. Thank you so much for having us. So I, like many people working in the sector, wear various hats. And I think the kind of most important one, I would say, is my work with both City of Sanctuary UK, which is a national umbrella organization supporting grassroots groups and communities to unite around welcoming people of sanctuary seeking background. And I also work for Reading City of Sanctuary, which is the kind of local group. In addition to that, by night, I'm also a councillor at a local authority, and I have the cabinet role for this area of work, so our services for refugees. But in terms of my Reading work, it is where I work with Fiona.
And the council, the local council, is Oxfordshire?
South Oxfordshire, yeah.
About you, Fiona, what do you do?
So I go to Greyfriars Church in Reading, and I'm involved with our refugee sanctuary seeker ministry there. So that's how I know Maggie. We've partnered in delivering a drop-in at Greyfriars.
Maggie, before we actually started the podcast, you started talking a bit about what's your experience actually of coming to this country, of not being, because you're not British, you know, you grow up here. And we met when we were 16, and you arrived fresh from Greece, but are Bulgarian. So,
yeah. It's really interesting, isn't it? I think there's, you know, in hindsight, you look back at, you know, how have I got here? And I remember I was always interested in migration, being of migrant background myself. And I remember I took kind of elective modules at university to specifically look at it. It always has fascinated me. So I think the first time I ever got involved was at university. And after that, I guess moving countries twice, from Bulgaria to Greece and Greece to the UK, there were certain challenges, and they were cultural, they were kind of about my identity as a young person and where I belonged. These are things that are very common when people move across borders. So I would say that's personal experience, certainly kind of intrigued, inspired my interest in this field. But I think it was around the time when I had to deal with the settled status, this retrospective policy where all Europeans had to apply to effectively make their leave in the UK permanent. And there is something really cruel about any retrospective policy, but the burden of proof was very much put on individuals themselves, despite never having done anything wrong. And so when I applied, and I had by that time been in the country for about 19 years, I was told that I wasn't eligible, which was really, really difficult.
Can you just explain that for people who like don't get that much of the system? After Brexit,
all Europeans were required to apply for what we call settled status. It's a kind of a bespoke scheme for Europeans that had been living and working more often than not in the country prior to Brexit, effectively. But there was a set date. And so we all had to, in the millions, apply for this scheme. And when I did, I was told I wasn't eligible. And that was in part, I mean, there are many reasons for that. I think as with any new system, the databases weren't really communicating, and I don't want to go too into it, but it was hugely disheartening and really dehumanizing, because you were kind of being made for whatever political decisions, rightly or wrongly, being put through kind of these hoops that you needed to jump through. And the burden of proof was on you. And the fact that it was retrospective meant that you may not have kept the records or the documentation that you needed in order to apply. So it was quite cruel. I decided...
All the time leading up to Brexit, you didn't need to worry about having to have certain documents or needing certain things. And then they were saying, well, actually now...
No, you need to prove
things that you didn't think you were going to need.
Yeah, you need to prove your existence effectively. And so I decided that at the time, but probably a few months before I applied, I was elected as councillor, and I thought, oh, this is something that I probably should do, because I recognize that many people in my position perhaps would just be terrified to challenge this. And so I did, and I went to the local press. So it wasn't anything, I didn't expect it to kind of blow up in the way that it did, but it did. And so for the next 2 weeks, I ended up doing press with various national media. It was really, really scary. And at one point, there was kind of me on one line and the Home Office on the other line and the journalist in the middle kind of communicating between us. But I definitely stood my ground. But I remember being in my car and like clutching the steering wheel and thinking like, oh, my gosh, these people hold my life and that of my family and my children who are, you know, British, you know, in their hands and being, you know, really quite, yeah, challenging them. But in the end, what they did is I didn't need to provide anything further. It just went away, which I think in itself showed that they accepted that they did something wrong. So I think, you know, it is really important for people that are, you know, have a platform of any kind or are in a position of privilege of any kind or just doing well themselves. It is so important to kind of stand for others, because I think ultimately, I think it is really important. We will all have been born with some relative gifts or privileges. And I would never judge anyone based on that, but it's what we do with it next that really matters. And I remember I said to you, Bex, I said, let a good crisis go to waste. So, you know, if you're experiencing something hard, then, you know, challenge the system that has made it hard for you and hopefully many others. Sadly, many others.
Mm. And you've done so well doing that. And Fiona, what about you? When, you know, what made you start to do the work that you've been doing at Greyfriars?
I feel like I'm a city of sanctuary case study, really. I didn't have any passion for this area of work. You know, I watched the TV and the news like everybody else, and watched the Syrian crisis, and you know, probably sent some funds to a charity, but didn't feel particularly that it was an area that I wanted to get involved with. And then there was a lady at church, Gemma Thomas, who did have a real passion for this area. And she'd heard about the community sponsorship part of the Vulnerable Person Resettlement Scheme. And so she wanted to put a group together at church. And I felt a nudge that that was, you know, something that I could help with. I could help with the application. I could help with project management. I have a background in chemical physics, so sort of sciencey stuff. I'd had experience in writing applications and project management. So I thought I could help with that. And I didn't really have much expectation of really getting involved with meeting the family and kind of doing the actual support side of things. But as it worked out, I had to, and I got really intensively involved. And it was that personal interaction, you know, hearing stories, talking, you know, that firsthand experience of speaking with someone that really hooked me. And I think, as we spent time supporting the family, it got me thinking that I'd lived in other countries. I'd been there either working or I'd been there with my husband. And, you know, it was a choice to go. It was extremely hard resettling, you know, even in that scenario in another country, even one where actually, you know, the language was the same. Just everything's different. You know, the administrative systems, everything's different. And we had our stuff with us, or it was in storage at home. You know, we could go home at any point and see our family. If it was really horrid, we could just leave it and go home. And it just got me really thinking that, you know, somebody within the sort of refugee system or the asylum system just can't do that. You know, they've not left home by their choice. They can't go home. Chances are, they're never going to see their family members again. They're certainly never going to see their home again and all their stuff again. They've lost everything. And that really connected me, really, with that issue and ignited a desire to help.
Mm. It is. It's like the stories, isn't it, of meeting individuals that really, I think, always changes people's perspective on stuff, which is sort of why I do this podcast, because it's telling these stories that people hear and suddenly from this kind of, I don't know, issue or thing that people talk about, it suddenly becomes so much more real.
Yeah, absolutely.
What happens at Greyfriars? So what does it look like? What is the support that you give?
So we started out with the community sponsorship.
Okay.
So that's where a group comes together, community group comes together, and takes full responsibility for resettling a family. And it's a collaboration between the Home Office and UNHCR and the International Organization for Migration, and families are taken directly from a host country, from where they've sort of initially fled to. And you take on full responsibility for finding them a home, supporting every aspect of their integration to, you know, through to the point where they become independent. So, you know, you help them sign up for their benefits, healthcare, schooling, volunteering and employment kind of opportunities, introducing them to the local areas. You take on full responsibility for doing that. We got to know, and during doing that, we got to know Maggie and City of Sanctuary. And we just started to think about, you know, what else could we do? You know, in moving forward, should we think about sponsoring another family through community sponsorship? Or is there some other way that we could help? And Greyfriars had been, there's been a long-standing building project at the church, and it was just sort of reached, well, long-standing in the sense of actually getting started on it, getting the funds together for it. We were just reaching the end of actually doing the building. About just over a year ago, and we've built this just beautiful space. It's really stunning space on the front of the church. It's an atrium building, which is a coffee shop and a bookshop, and it's a space which is just filled with light and just looks welcoming without, you know, having anybody in it actually welcoming people. And it was, you know, how can we use this space to reach out, not just, you know, reach out to the community as a whole, but in terms of my passion, reach out specifically to refugees and asylum seekers. And I got thinking about when I lived in Paris. So I was in Paris with my kids when I've got twins, when they were two and a half, three, so really little. They were going to a nursery, but it was really isolating. I didn't speak particularly good French. You know, you're spending a lot of time trucking children backwards and forwards. I didn't really know anyone. And it wasn't until I got to know a few of the other mums, as you do when you've got small children. But we would drop the kids. We were all in the same situation. We would drop the kids off at school. We would go to the local coffee shop every morning and sit and plan an attack for the day. You know, how are we going to do this task, which ordinarily would be really simple in a country where we don't understand how anything works and don't speak the language very well. So we would have we used to call them board meetings every morning, and we would, you know, support each other, work out how we were going to, what we were going to do. You know, ultimately, obviously, became the best of friends, and that utterly changed my life. And I thought, you know, if we could do something like that for refugees and asylum seekers, provide a space where they could meet, build relationships, actually provide some support as well in helping them navigate as far as we can, you know, where we can help them navigate systems here. That would be a great thing to do. And we partner with Maggie at City of Sanctuary. And it's, you know, we had one person the first week, nearly a year ago now. We have about 100 people every week now. It's just amazing, amazing the way it's grown, and I love it.
Yeah,
and I think it was very much an organic thing, wasn't it? I think we, so at Reading City of Sanctuary, but actually any kind of City of Sanctuary group around the country, what we do is we look to work with the mainstream. We believe that everyone, whether you're a school or a university or a council or church or another place of worship, you have a role to play in creating effectively a local refugee framework in the absence of a coherent or a compassionate one on a national level. I think that what we're seeing in the UK on a national level is all these various schemes, whether it's resettlement schemes or people arriving through irregular routes or people arriving and claiming asylum, or the Ukraine scheme, or there's just so many. And they all come with different eligibility to public funds. They are all slightly, they are actually very, very complicated. So what we're trying to do on a local level is mitigate against that, very much putting the individuals and really the value and the contribution that they bring to a local community and kind of shape local services, whether they're statutory services or voluntary services, and shape them in a way that prioritizes them and helps to kind of get integration, as they say, started on day one. And so working with churches is something that we do on a local level in Reading, but we also work with the university and the council and the museums, and we're creating this tapestry, if that's probably a nice visual, of welcoming places where a new arrival, very much like Fiona and I have found ourselves to be throughout life, can walk into a place and be met with that understanding of their situation, of what can be a really complicated situation, so that we kind of remove the need to constantly advocate, you know, for their existence, for their well-being. And so we try to kind of ease the load by creating these welcoming places. And we do that, and this is what I was telling Fiona, and what I love about our work with Greyfriars is that, you know, if you look at the atrium and it's this really kind of beautifully chaotic place on every Friday, you cannot kind of credit one person. The space has a big role to play, the people, the volunteers, just working together. And it's this really magical place in many sense, but it is not an easy. What we're doing isn't easy. We have incredibly sad stories of, you know, people being homeless, of people, you know, even, you know, people trying to commit suicide. So it's really quite heavy. But because we all share that kind of load together, including people, you know, with lived experience at Seeking Sanctuary, they are our peers and our partners in all of this. And they really do help as well. We have how many people volunteering at
Eight volunteers who are sanctuary seekers themselves.
We are incredibly proud, and I think it is a case study of what City of Sanctuary, you know, groups do nationally. I think there's about 130 local City of Sanctuary groups working incredibly hard to create these tapestries of welcome and solidarity on a local level, and it is really beautiful. And so one thing I wanted to mention. So what happened March? Fiona got in touch and said, we've got this place, it's opening. What do you think we should do? You know, we've got this slot on a Friday. I think should we open it up? So we kind of started talking about it. And as Fiona said, yeah, we only probably had one person, you know, or maybe a handful. And I remember distinctly saying to Fiona, be careful what you wish for. And it has really, really grown from there. And I knew it would. I think it had all the right ingredients. And so now, I mean, during school holidays, all the sanctuary seekers bring their kids, as do I. I bring my kids too. And it can get quite chaotic. But it is wonderful.
And from your work, what do you feel now about the situation for refugees? I feel like if you look on the news, on Twitter, there's so much being said about refugees right now. But from your experience of people coming, I guess they're asylum seekers and refugees, what's the reality like really for them?
I think what very sadly, I think in September of last year, internationally, we reached a really sad milestone of 100 million people being displaced from their homes. That includes internally displaced people as well. And I think it is the war in Ukraine that very much kind of the numbers spiked as a result of that. But these 100 million are people who really, as Fiona said earlier, really don't want to be living anywhere but home. One of the kind of misconceptions is that people really want to be here, and that is not the case. I think they come here because they speak English, or they have some friends, or they have families, or there's some kind of colonial links, or there is no knowledge about kind of systems and benefits. Again, this is another misconception. I mean, Fiona and I do help people with understanding their eligibility for various support, and I can tell you that nobody, not even us, really understand what your entitlements are, and there is no chance that people from kind of fleeing war would have any understanding. I think it's very interesting. We had Sky News come to the atrium on Friday. Ukrainian refugee said, "We came here and we were so excited because it's the land of James Bond and the Queen," and at the time, and so it's really things like that that drive people to try to find safety and rebuild their lives here. It's such a complicated area of work. Migration generally, immigration law has changed, I think, something like 14,000 times over, the last 10 or whatever years. It is very rapid. And I believe it is complicated by design. And the best way, I think, to simplify it is to come into contact with people of sanctuary-seeking background, because, we learn a lot from people as they experience the challenges, but also it's the only way that you would really see that these are just your peers, just caught up in really awful, really unfortunate situations through no fault of their own. And I think that is how we move forward, is by having that contact and really appreciating, we've got a chemistry teacher. We have somebody who actually worked in the military at Afghanistan that arrived through a small boat. We have people from Ukraine who are so desperate to find, housing and are so unable to because their status is temporary and a bit strange because they're not technically refugees according to UK law. So it's just really seeing, having that interaction and getting involved in a direct way is the only way to really come to grips with what is incredibly dynamic sector and incredibly complicated.
I feel like we've intentionally set out to be as unwelcoming as we possibly can to people, fleeing war and persecution. And you sit down and you talk with somebody, be that the chap who's a chemist. So we've had it. We're able to talk about our shared geeky love of chemistry.
Where's he from?
And we're in another Afghanistan. And there's a lady from Ukraine who I met really early on, and I feel like we're a similar age. And it's not till she shared her experience of how she got out, of how she spent the couple of weeks getting out, and she showed me a picture of what she looked like standing on the Reading street when she got here. And she said, "I can't believe that's what I looked like. I cannot believe," because she looks just looks like me now. I think it just really, really brings it home to you that we're all just people, and it could be any one of us. We need to be much kinder to people because it could easily be us.
Because I feel like recently there's been a thing of actually it's mainly Albanians coming for economic opportunities and it's sort of men coming from safe countries to find work. What would you say about that?
I've got some statistics which Fiona will particularly enjoy. So actually about 15% of people arriving in small boats, and that's in 2022, were actually from Afghanistan, and 22% are from Iran. And yes, absolutely, there are people from Albania, but nonetheless, 77% of all people arriving via small boats get their refugee status approved on first application. They have rights to appeal, so that number kind of tends towards 80 on appeal. So that is an exceptionally high number. It means
they've got genuine reasons of which they're
fleeing. It's not an easy process. They have to prove absolutely, categorically that they cannot you know, be returned to their country of origin. In terms of the Albanians, I know it's a really much talked about topic. And again, coming from a small and relatively poor Eastern European countries, I implore anyone to really come to grips and understand what the issues are there. I think trafficking and until recently, people who experienced modern slavery can claim asylum. Of course, that has now been kind of made more progressively more difficult, but the situation in Albania is really, really dire. And I recently this really interesting BBC Sounds piece about the situation and why people are fleeing, and especially women. You know, it's a very patriarchal society with women being quite regularly trafficked. And actually, in my time working in the refugee sector, I've come to know a lot of women who have escaped trafficking from Albania. And what is really, really sad is that once they get pregnant, they basically dispose of them. So how do you then return this person to a place where that is quite likely to happen again? So I am not saying it's simple, but I think it's fair that people who are fleeing have that right to a hearing. And I think this is something that we need to guard with all that we can. You know, having our cases heard is something really, really important. But yes, I think what is key here is that we need to kind of not throw the baby with the bathwater. You know, in the vast majority of cases, people have genuine claims. And what we're doing by making them wait for a really long time whilst their claims are protested or making these claims and then proving them increasingly difficult is we are keeping people in a system where they face poverty, they face destitution, they are de-skilled, they lose any kind of skills that they have had, professional or otherwise. They are re-traumatized. We are traumatizing them again. We are also, in many cases, putting them in places such as these contingency hotels. And I'm happy to explain a little bit more about what they are. But we are institutionalizing them as well, making it that much harder. And it's when they get their claims approved, because in more often than not, they will, making it even harder for them to become kind of fully participating members of the local communities. What really is sad is that I remember when I first started working in the sector, certainly people from Iran would get their refugee status approved within months. Now they're having to wait over a year, 2 years, 3 years. And a very sad statistic I recently heard is that if we continue with this backlog in terms of making decisions, and this is very much due to lack of capacity in terms of Home Office workers, caseworkers that process these claims, but also obviously increasing numbers and also this increase in hostility, that on the same trajectory, if we stay on the same trajectory, it can take for up to 11 years for an asylum claim to be processed. And what a waste of precious human life that is. And usually that translates to children, because they will be living in relative uncertainty and poverty as well. I just feel the way that the system works now, we are kind of playing a really, really dangerous game where we're wasting human potential and life.
In terms of the numbers of Home Office personnel processing claims, that there is a plan, it's been enacted, that they're recruiting more. So there's currently only 500 odd, and by next, which is amazing to think there's only 500 odd people processing all these claims, but there's a plan to increase that to 2,500 or to recruit another 2,500, can't quite remember, by, you know, in the next 6 months or so. So that, I mean, there's hope that they'll start processing faster.
Because claims aren't being processed as quickly as they need to be, normally where people of sanctuary seeking background are housed is what we call dispersal accommodation or asylum accommodation. And they're usually kind of your HMOs, your big kind of tower blocks, the kind of hard to let or unlettable accommodation that is kind of made barely habitable. And so that estate, the dispersal estate, is basically full. And so once people get their positive decision, that they have only 28 days to leave that accommodation, which is incredibly challenging. So after, you know, this long process of having to kind of justify your claim, and you get the happy news and you've got 28 days to leave and to start your life, you know, get everything in place, get a new home, which is usually why a lot of people with recently approved refugee status end up homeless. And so because the dispersal estate has been full, what has been happening is these contingency hotels have been stood up with very little notice to the local authority or local kind of community infrastructure, just trying to help support them. And they have nothing. I had one, you may know who I mean, Fiona, a little Iranian three-year-old that didn't have like pants, you know, like nothing, you like no clothes, nothing at all. And you just think, you know, how basic that is. And it's usually the kind of volunteering community sector that support them. 5,000 of people who arrived in via small boats were separated children. So they're what people call unaccompanied asylum seekers. And because local authorities don't have the capacity to bring them into care so they become looked after children, so foster care, at speed, they have been placed in hotels, and the legislation is such that they can't be detained. And that's why we have heard about some places where these children have been going missing. And I should say we've got two separated children that come to the atrium, and I love them so much. they're ever so sweet, and even, you know, they're 16 and 17. They really want to volunteer, and it really just goes to show how much people, young people, but all sanctuary seekers are so incredibly keen to get involved, to work, but they're just not allowed to. So volunteering is something that we've been doing quite a bit of, trying to get them, you know, to kind of spend their days so preventing this kind of de-skilling that is happening, keeping them, helping them to integrate despite the challenges that are imposed on them. But yeah, these two young guys, they're so lovely, and they keep on coming because they're out of school, because there's no places at college. And so we have set them up with, we are partnering with a couple of climbing clubs. So set them up with that. And we are looking at a homework club that one of the local schools are doing in the evenings, just to kind of help get them out of, because they're in a care facility. They're not in homes. We're foster carers. Trying to kind of help them integrate as much as possible and to have things to do, because they're incredibly bored and also vulnerable. Young boys at that age can be impressionable and quite vulnerable to be.
Have they come together? Are they siblings?
They're not. No, they're. It's interesting. One of them is from Iraq and the other one from Iran, but they're both from Kurdish backgrounds. So that's how they've just very fortuitously, and in the kind of house or care facility that they're in, there is four separated children, asylum seeking children, and they are, I think, one from Sudan and one, I think, from Afghanistan, and two of them from Iran, something like that.
And people coming from Iran, you said that's quite a high percentage. Why would they be coming? Why would they be leaving Iran?
They're from a persecuted minority, so Kurdish or Christian is one of them. And some of them are kind of political refugees. So if they've said anything against the government, they also are quite swiftly arrested, and really awful things happen to them. So even, you know, when there is an arrest warrant, they just go. I mean, I had, this goes back some time, one Iranian refugee. The reason they fled is he was an artist. He was a sculptor. And in their roundabouts, in the middle of their roundabouts, they have sculptures. And I think one of the sculptures was a bit suggestive. So then there was a warrant out for his arrest, and so they fled, him and his wife.
I think most of the Iranians at the drop-in are Christians. So we have a really exciting Farsi ministry at Grey Friars now. We actually have a couple of Farsi-speaking members of staff now, which is fantastic. And they, one of them is an ambassador for Elam Ministries, which is Farsi-speaking ministry. And yeah, it's really exciting. So we've had a Farsi Alpha. We've had there's Farsi small groups, and yeah, lots of volunteers. Can notice last week that the Arash, who leads the Farsi ministry at church, he would normally be running, you know, leading the small group. I noticed he was still sitting in the drop-in while a small group was going on in church. So actually, you know, he's discipled somebody else who's now able to lead that group. So that's all. Yeah, that's really exciting.
That's amazing. That's so cool. And for you both, you know, what seeing what people are saying out there in the world, or Suella Braverman's trying to send people to Rwanda, do you think that has an, you know, do you think that changes how we should all see things? Like, is it really important to be doing things for refugees or asylum seekers, or like, will the government take care of people, or do we actually need to all be doing things to help people come?
I'll take that one. So one of the things that I've been listening, we not only to Suella Braverman, but also I want to say, who was he? The previous Home Secretary that was only Home Secretary for a couple of days, really, under Liz Truss. But what I find absolutely incredible is how little they understand the system. So, for example, I hope that it is a misunderstanding rather than, kind of promoting this misunderstanding on purpose. But the fact that there's no safe routes. So this family we have from Afghanistan, and that came a couple of weeks ago to the atrium. And so he used to work for the military in Afghanistan. And yet they've had to make their own way here via irregular routes. And she was pregnant. And so they're now were placed in a hotel, one of these contingency hotels. And they will wait God knows how long for their claim to be processed. And the reason they have done that is because wherever they were in neighboring countries, they just had no way, no safe way of getting here. And so there just isn't. I think resettlement programs is something that, you know, government talks about quite a lot. But last year we only, and this is kind of the evacuation of, August of 2020 now, aside, last, sorry, 2021. So in 2022, we only resettled about 1,400 people. So it's only 1,400 people, not families, that had access to a safe route. That's it.
And yet, you know, we welcomed, quite rightly, over 100,000 Ukrainians. Okay. You know, you don't see a Ukrainian on a, you know, there's been no Ukrainians on a small boat because they had a safe and legal route to get here.
Mm. And that's the other thing is, you know, in the Refugee Convention of 1951, there is a provision that people may use irregular routes, but as long as they claim asylum on arrival, their status is effectively regularized until such time that their claim is heard. So there is no such thing as an illegal refugee or an illegal asylum seeker. They're not, by definition. And I think saying otherwise, it's really disingenuous. And I find it really, really quite hard, and especially, you know, in these cases where you see that you know people have taken that route because out of desperation, you know, and in this case with the family from Afghanistan, you know, we clearly have a responsibility. The reason he can't live there is because he supported our military, right? And yet he is experiencing that very same hostile system. Only 1% have that access to safe routes, which is really, really tiny. Inevitably, people will make their own way here and take incredibly, incredibly dangerous routes. And, you know, sometimes you see, oh, why do we see, you know, men coming? And I think that's quite a, there's two reasons, and it's probably another myth I would like to dispel, is that the strategy is that those who are kind of physically more able to make the dangerous journeys and then family, they can apply for families to be reunited. And the second one is, you know, in places like Eritrea, for example, where there is a compulsory conscription, a lot of the young men, and sometimes, you know, we see these separated children leave because they don't want to be fighting, usually for things they don't believe in. So we do see a young man for that reason. And it's quite normal. Ultimately, though, one thing to remember is that 41% of all refugees are children. Really, this is about really, really innocent children. It's quite an important aspect to consider when getting in.
And now that everyone's sort of worried about the cost of living and the impact of that, you know, people struggling themselves in this country and then saying we can't afford to have more people come and support more people, what do you say when people say that?
And I think one of the cruelest things is to frame a question in a way which is, well, we need to help our own first. I think there's so many barriers already that exist that kind of make the playing field not level for people of migrant background. But I also think, why would we kind of pit one vulnerable community against another? I feel like that is one of the most cruel things that we can be doing, because both are deserving of support and help, and it should be based on, you know, their needs. Like, you know, preventing homelessness is something that we should be doing for all. I think in a country which is, what is it, the sixth wealthiest country in the world, we can certainly afford that. And migrant populations are very much being scapegoated, and that is the fact that over many years now we have seen this pressure on public services. I think ultimately people of migrant background, more or less, you know, if you can kind of, if you start differentiating between, you know, Europeans and people from, you know, further afield, but generally speaking, they're much younger, they're less likely to use, you know, the NHS. Generally speaking, I am going to go with general. We certainly need people to, and we can see the shortages we have in so many industries now. We also know that because there is no kind of social safety net in many of the countries that people come from, they're a lot more likely to want to work and to be self-sufficient because there's just never been another option, another viable option for them. So I think what's important to recognize is that, you know, migrant populations are more or less, you know, contributing for what they take out in public services. So if we're seeing this pressure on public services, that is a political decision not to resource public services better. We know from Scandinavian countries where, you know, taxes are potentially higher, they have much better public services. You know, so that is something that we need to think about very carefully. I know it's hard. I know it's hard. So to sum up, really the pressure we're seeing on public services is, I think, ideologically driven. I think it's not, you know, the kind of political decisions we had, you know, even 10, 15 years ago, they were a lot more pragmatic. We've kind of moved to a place where, you know, it's all about slogans and ideology. And I think all parties really can benefit from getting back to having these much more pragmatic discussions around the role of public services and not scapegoat really, really marginalized communities in the meanwhile, because it's no good for anyone to create this division. Ultimately, we can see the social fabric of local communities being torn apart as a result. I genuinely think it's a situation that we can make work for everyone, because we need younger people of working age. We have a demographic time bomb here. We have incredible amount of shortages in so many different sectors now. So I think there is a win-win. And I think these are the kind of sober conversations and much more pragmatic that we need to be having around post-migration, but migration generally, and what that means in terms of public service provision.
Just following on, you know, from that, that we have to have those conversations, because this is a problem which isn't going away. You know, with climate change, there's as an example, we're only going to see increasing numbers of people, you know, having to migrate for one reason or another. So it's only going to get worse. So we have to find a way to make it work.
The problem with, you know, public services and these is a much bigger than you know, this relatively small you know, percentage of people who experience displacement.
I think one of the things you said earlier, Max, was that these people come, but not because they're aware of some like great benefit system that they think they're coming to access. They're coming here to stop, to not work and live off benefits for the rest of their life, and that's what they're kind of coming here for. But actually, you know, services are short. We do need people from other countries, and that this sort of, I think what the story that isn't told in the press, I think, is the benefit that refugees can bring to our country. It's all that they're going to come and take our resources, but what about the work that they're going to do, the nurses, the carers, and all of those public services workers that do come from other parts of the world?
And one of the projects, just to give a little bit of a tangible example, is we are working with the local bus company who are really struggling to hire bus drivers. And despite putting up, you know, wages for quite a bit, they just don't exist. And so we've been working to try and remove some of the barriers so that, and I think we've had a couple so far of refugees who have their status now who have been able to start work as bus drivers. But, you know, the issues with drivers are widespread, and so that's been really great. And yeah, I genuinely believe that there is a kind of a win-win here if we do it well, and if we do it early before, you know, we cause more harm to people than we need to. Asylum seekers, so people still in the asylum system, those in hotels live on £9 a week. That doesn't even get them a couple of, you know, bus journeys to their ESOL classes or even to come and see us. You know, it is incredibly, incredibly difficult to live on that money. And remember, they have to buy clothes. They have to, you know, take their kids to school and get stuff for their kids. They get food. The food is incredibly awful, and there is just no way of changing it. I think a lot of the moms from Eritrea that come to see us, they say that the food is too spicy for their kids to eat. We've had people with dietary requirements such as diabetes really not getting the right nutrition, or pregnant ladies, and people are pregnant, can you believe it? And raising children in these hotels, and they're tiny rooms. You know, I think it's important to know when we talk about hotels, it's usually like really not tiny small rooms. They have to eat their meals. They can't eat them together. They have to take them and take them up to their rooms. So effectively like prison. And yes, it's not suitable food for these kind of dietary requirements. And it takes an incredible amount of advocacy on their behalf to try and get the right things, you know, because of allergies or celiac or whatever. And those who are not in hotels, those who are in, as I said, dispersal accommodation, they get, I think it's just gone up to £45 a week. Out of that, they have to pay for absolutely everything, including food. And all the while, they would rather work. They would rather not have this. They want to be able to work. And a lot of them have, you know, real skills that they can add and that we need, and they're just not allowed to. And that's why a lot of the kind of voluntary sector or faith communities, and actually we're so lucky in Reading, we have faith communities are quite active. Certainly the church communities are incredibly active in supporting from everything, you know, from collections, to drop-ins, to you name it, doing lunches. I mean, Fiona may want to talk about New Hope and this new project that we're hoping to start up to mitigate against the lack of, you know, food and adequate nutrition in hotels.
Yeah, we've got a kitchen at New Hope, so that's a partner church, which isn't far away. And actually, we'll have a kitchen at Greyfriars when the new centre's finished. So that might be a possibility as well also. And we just want to work out how we could open that up a bit so that people from hotels could come and do some cooking, you know, maybe have a shared lunch, to you know, take it in turns to cook, have a shared lunch together, so that builds some community and some relationship, maybe do a bit of English conversation around the subject of food in some way. Party at Christmas, which was just such a great occasion. So it was a bring and share, you know, Christmas party. Of course, anybody in the hotel couldn't cook. So we wanted to, you know, they were asking, how could we contribute? It's like, well, why don't we open up the New Hope Kitchen? And so that's what happened. And so people were able to cook their own food. And there was just such delight in this amazing spread. I mean, it was just an amazing spread, wasn't it, Maggie, of food? Or from all, you know, lots of different nations. And you know, I had people coming up saying, oh, try my dish. And just such delight taking, be able to share and contribute to a bigger, you know, bigger event.
I guess you're also saying you see people's desire to contribute.
Yeah.
Rather than just because they can be that preconception or counters conceive.
They come from much more kind of, I mean, hospitality is a really big thing for people from like Syria and Afghanistan and Ukraine as well. And so they absolutely love to be able to. And Ukrainians being in host situations, they can't really host people, likewise people in the hotel. So for them, having the opportunity and actually feeding us.
Yeah, we can keep getting boxes of cakes at the moment, don't we? It's great.
But these lovely grannies, and I have a favourite granny whose English is really, really improved. And we have a special English session for grannies. We call it English for Grannies on a Saturday, so that they can have support with somebody who speaks the language and try and kind of help them. Because although they're grannies, they are pre-retirement age. I think it seems that, you know, Ukrainians marry and have children fairly young comparatively, I think. So the grannies are actually not very old at all. But they do face additional challenges in terms of accessing the labour market. And so we've got this special session for them. But they love to cook. And oh, my goodness, they brought every time there is an opportunity to kind of bring food. Oh, my goodness. And one of them once came and to me and Fiona, and she had this like really big kind of problem she seriously wanted to talk to us about, and she sat us down. Do you remember,
Fiona? Is this a demijohn for cider making?
To see where she can get a jar to make cider with the apples that had fallen from the tree in her home.
And we're like, just like 10 minutes researching demijohns with her.
It's really great. I mean, we do have like the smallest of issues to the biggest of issues. It all happens. We tackle them together. We bring whatever we can. And again, this is like one partnership. There's many really wonderful partnerships that you know, we're working on. And hopefully we can elevate them to be as good as this one. But really, the message is that whoever you are, whatever your situation, there is a role to play, whether you're a teacher and want to see if your school can become a school of sanctuary, or a librarian where, you know, the library can become a place of sanctuary too, or anywhere you find yourself, no matter how busy, no matter, you know, what your means are, there is something for everyone to do. And it is really, really heartwarming and amazing.
That's so cool. It's great to hear what both of you do. So my last question that I always ask is, what is the greatest inequality you see in the world from your experience?
We've covered a lot of it, really, I think. But I think the huge inequality in our immigration system in the UK. You know, we have a number of refugee schemes we had a, you know, the Syrian scheme where 20,000 people were resettled in the UK over 5 years. I think the Afghan scheme is another 20,000 over a number of years. The new resettlement scheme, there are no numbers, but as Maggie said, you know, we only resettled not many over 1,000 last year. Wonderful Ukrainian scheme, completely the other end of the scale, over 100,000. And then we have asylum seekers who get so little help. And actually with the new borders and immigration bill, they're going to be different levels of asylum seeking, you know, as well. If you come by an irregular route, then you won't even be able to claim asylum. So I think, you know, that's for me is, you know, it's the huge inequality, and we just need to address our immigration system and come up with a fair system, you know, that treats people with kindness and with dignity.
Yeah. I completely agree. I'm trying to come up with something can match this. Because I've lived in Bulgaria, which is, you know, the poorest country in the EU, and then having kind of moved to Greece and again to the UK, you know, with relative privilege. Because of my mum's work and what really has struck me is that people and humans can experience life in such a profoundly different way. And more often than not, that has nothing to do with their decisions. It is just where they're born, what country, what family to, et cetera, et cetera. And those differences are something that I find really, really hard to reconcile. Systems, and especially systems in the UK, really compound these differences in how people experience their lives. And I feel that there needs to be a really concerted effort to remove the barriers to accessing support and services, whatever they may be. Especially as a counsellor, it's been really interesting and to kind of understand what can be done. And really interesting also to challenge my own perceptions, because when you meet a person that is in need, in my case, what the most important thing to ask, or at least be aware of and recognize, is that I don't know what this person's situation is, what their lived experience is, and to kind of hold yourself back from judging whether they are kind of worthy of accessing this support, because sometimes the lives people lead, even in this country, are really incredibly difficult. And again, one of the most startling discoveries is that so much of it is through kind of community and family breakdown, believe it or not, that puts people, so not having a social network like our people of sanctuary seeking backgrounds that have been displaced, lack of kind of family support system, these things really, really matter. And when they're not there, systems can really penalize people.
Yeah, and actually that... It's amazing that the church can play such a huge role and be that space.
Yeah, absolutely. We should be offering welcome and support as a church. And you know, I'm quite certain if Jesus were walking around on the earth, he would be in that space, sitting and talking to refugees, sharing food, having conversation, building relationships. So it's wonderful to be demonstrating God's love.
And challenging systems.
And challenging the systems, actually. Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, it's wonderful to be demonstrating his love, you know, through this kind of work, yeah.
Thank you so much, both of you, for doing it. It's been so great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. And if you want to find out more, I'll leave a link in the show notes to find out more about the City of Sanctuary and about the work at Greyfriars Church. But I'm sure they'd appreciate any support, or if you want to find ways to become places of sanctuary where you live and in the places that you're involved in. And if you could leave a comment, I would really appreciate it. The more likes or comments that the show gets, the better that it is for the algorithm, and the more that other people get to hear about it. So please share and tell people about it. And thank you so much for listening.